me in.
Engage.
Gee. I haven't had this many people at this panel since the first time I ever did it.
How was that?
About 5 years ago.
Before times.
Hey, I'm old, but I'm not that old. We got a few more minutes. I'd like to just introduce myself. My name is Michael Lutrario. I go by the badge name Brer Badger. Years ago, my ex-wife decided to give me that badge name. She said I had a temper like a badger. Funny, I haven't lost my temper since I got my divorce. But I am also the owner of M&T Comics. I have a table in the dealer den, and hopefully I'll keep the commercials to a minimum. And I started this panel a few years ago because I had a lot of younger people, mostly your age, not yours, who would come up to my table and say, gee, I never knew there was so much stuff that had been published for the fandom. And, you know, my immediate response was, well, you know the fandom is older than you are, right? And it is. And I guess we'll get started. The fandom actually began in the mid to late 70s. Now, you got to take it into a different kind of context than you have today. Because, come on in, there's a one chair left over here. One over there, another one over there. Help yourself. The fandom began at a time when technology is not the way it is today. And for the most part, that means no internet, no cell phones, no personal computers, and it's a little difficult for some of the people your age even comprehend such things never existed. But in the 70s, a group of people, some the names you might know, probably most you don't, there was Reed Waller, who is the artist on a title called Omaha the Cat Dancer, Kate Worley, who wrote the story for Omaha, and her husband, Ken Fletcher, a few other people who had a different idea about what might be fun at a convention. They would go to a regular comic book convention and do the usual sketches and art drawings for superheroes and whatever people were buying, they would do to pick up a few bucks. When the dealer room was closed, however, these people would meet and have like a private room party. And they started talking about things that they liked, didn't have too much interest in the that the general public had, but they liked to do. And they started talking about things and sketching, and little by little, anthropomorphics came about. Somebody drew some funny animals and put clothes on them. Because back in those days, anthropomorphics had been in comics for several decades. You can find old Golden Age comics dated from the 30s and 40s that have squirrels and crows and foxes and what have you that would interact like folks do. Maybe not so much with clothes on, but they did interact and talk. And little by little, this progressed to those room parties where the artists I mentioned started giving them more human qualities and more human interaction, putting them in houses and driving cars and so forth. Up until this point, all of that had been referred to in the comic industry as funny animal comics. And that's where it stood. Until a big breakthrough occurred. Now, this breakthrough was in technology, but not what you might be thinking of. Up until this point, even though Reed and Ken Fletcher and some of these others started producing publications for sale, what they did was they just drew sketches on paper and then went to the local post office or the local library and used a Xerox machine for 15 cents a sheet and put together something like this that they would fold in half and make it into a little book with a couple of staples or a piece of tape or whatever to hold it together. And that's what we call the fanzine. Now, there's still some out there and about. They're more collected by older furs who like to remember the good old days. And it also carries a lot of interesting artwork that is no longer available, partly because a lot of the people that made those fanzines are no longer with us. Now, once the breakthrough in technology that I'm about to tell you occurred, things changed drastically for the fandom. That breakthrough in technology was a machine that IBM built for the government. The federal government went to IBM and they said, "We need you to build a machine that can be programmed to hold books. We want this machine to be able to print these books and bind these books, and we want them to be done so that they can be published anywhere portably in multiple languages." Because the government was involved in a lot of different programs, along with the Peace Corps, to bring education to third world countries. And they found it was very expensive to have educational material printed in America, pack up huge crates of these books in multiple languages and ship them all over the world. It was much easier if you could take a machine the size of this table, hook it up to a portable generator with a few reams of paper, and this week we're chunking out math books in Swahili, and next week they're doing agricultural books in whatever language they have in Bangladesh, or some other third world country that the Peace Corps wanted to bring education to. And once that machine was established, smaller people became aware that, hey, not only can we have math books and agricultural books and English, language books printed, but we can have comic books printed too. We can have all kinds of books printed on this machine. And it's now affordable to have a less expensive production. Because up until this point, there were only two printers in North America, one in Canada and one in Sparta, Illinois, who printed comic books. And if anyone here wanted to have a comic book printed, you could go to Sparta, Illinois, and say, I want to have this comic book printed. And they would say, okay, no problem. How many 100,000 copies do you want? Because we only do a minimum order of 200,000 copies. We have to cut the zinc printing plates by hand, and they have to have 5 plates for every page. That's why comic books are called four color, because there's 4 separate colors and 1 for the ink outline. 5 plates for every page of every comic. And although Marvel and DC and Charlton and a couple of other companies could afford this, the small guy on the street who wants 500 or 1,000 copies couldn't. Not until this machine became available. And once it did, then the small press industry in comics began. And that started in the early 80s. The first comic that actually utilized the term anthropomorphics instead of funny animals is this one. This is the very first anthropomorphic comic ever printed. There are only 450 comics of this comic printed, because even though the machine made it easier and cheaper to print at a much lower level, it was still a bit expensive to have a quantity made. This particular book, as I said, utilized the term anthropomorphics, and to the best of my knowledge, out of the 450 print run that this occurred, there's less than 100 left in the world. I tell people, every time the news comes on and we see, oh, this town is wiped out by a tornado, or that town is wiped out by a flood in California, or a wildfire, or something else, you know, and everybody goes, God, what a terrible thing to happen. And the first thing that runs through my mind is, how many comic book collections were in that town? you know, and it's a shame, but, you know, there are other things besides just the general stuff that people lose, like pictures and homes and what have you. The collectibles that they had in those homes is also gone. Now, we've gotten to the point where comic books have now gotten to a much easier level to be printed, and so now small press publishers have the ability to go to a print shop that has one of these machines and says, okay, I want to have 100 copies made, or 200, or 500. In most cases, if you look at the inside of some of the, what you would call vintage comics from the 80s and 90s, on the inside of the front cover, in what's called the indicata, and that's the information from the publisher where it tells you the name of the publisher, their address, and a few other bits and pieces of information, it will also give you a print run. And that print run was usually 2,000 copies. And in most cases, the publishers at the time, Moo Press, Antarctic Press, Fantagraphics, Radio Comics, Shanda Fantasy came along. These people found that a 2,000 copy print run was affordable, and they had plenty of copies to sell initially, with backup copies for as the fandom grew. Those copies would still be available for new furs to join in and not be left trying to figure out where did the story begin? Because like with this one, there was only 450 printed. This book was actually reprinted three more times. There's a second, third, and fourth printing. But even today, the fourth printing has a value of about $25, and the publisher is completely out of business now, so they're never going to print anymore. But these things are available depending upon the level of monetary ability that you have. This one here, I have a price tag of $1,000 on. And it's not the holy grail of furry comics. There's one other out there that runs somewhere between $10,000 and $15,000. And that's Albedo number 2. And it features the very first appearance of Usagi Yojimbo, which is a samurai rabbit that many of you may be familiar with who hung out with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in the cartoons. Yeah, that's Usagi. He was actually around long before the Turtles, and his first appearance is worth a tremendous amount of money. So, now, as the fandom started to grow, and more people became involved in it, the convention circuit started. Very first comic convention was in the early 80s in California. It was called Conference Zero. They didn't even give it it was Conference, and they didn't give it a number. It's now referred to as number zero, but the very first one, they just called it Conference because they weren't even sure they were going to have another one. I think they had an attendance of roughly 50 people. And when you consider that a comic convention in California at the time usually ran 5,000 or 6,000, 50 people was not a lot. But it caught on. Again, still no internet. It was just word of mouth. People would go home, talk to their friends about it. Oh man, I went to this cool new thing. And it was really an eye-opener, so much different from, you know, usual mainstream comic book convention or sci-fi convention. And it was really a breath of fresh air. And so people started talking about it more. There was a second one. They actually called it Conference One. So then other people said, hey, maybe we should try this where we live. Because everybody was traveling all across the country from word of mouth and letters from friends and whatever, telling them about this new convention in California. So people went to it and said, we could have one of these in Minneapolis. We could have one of these in Kansas City. We could have one in New York. And so people would go home and try and organize their own convention, drawing more people to the fandom, making more people aware of the kind of material that's available, and more people started doing things. More artists started joining in. Publishers that were more involved with comics that were not just furry, but other things, like Fantagraphic, started carrying anthropomorphic titles. Once they started getting out into regular comic stores, then more people started joining in, and more people, more conventions, and it just started to inflate over the years. Now, one of the things that makes this fandom so different than all the others is that, and I've been to sci-fi cons, I've been to mainstream cons, I've been to ElfQuest cons, I've been to, you name it, if they ever had a con, I've been there. But one of the things that makes this con unique among all the others is the open-mindedness of the fans. It's not the sex like they talk about when they make fun of our convention on TVs and movies. They all talk about, oh yeah, furries, they're a bunch of sex-crazed maniacs. Let me tell you something. You go to a sci-fi convention, there's just as many Darth Vaders stupping Wonder Woman. So, you know, there's no difference. And, you know, just because we wear maybe a yellow polka dot green dragon and for a costume, or a lion with a Roman centurion outfit on top of his lion costume, doesn't make us any different than somebody in a Darth Vader suit or a Star Trek uniform. We're all the same inside. Some of us have those urges more than others, but, you know, that's for room parties later. And let me tell you something. Those Star Trek conventions, those people are insane. I mean, you walk into the con floor and you're wearing the wrong badge on the wrong shirt, the wrong color shirt, they'll toss you off the roof of the hotel. They're crazy. But the open-mindedness of our fandom makes it more inviting, I think, than some of the other conventions, because we don't care who you are inside, because we're all the same, and we enjoy the interaction more because we're all different and because we all accept one another. You don't have the level of animosity here that you do at other conventions, whether it's because you're wearing the wrong shirt or somebody just doesn't like you for whatever reason. Here, I've never met people who didn't like me. And I've been doing this. I started my career in furry fandom in 1979. I found it by accident. I was in the military at the time. I went to a convention in California, and there was a guy selling this really unusual, different kind of artwork. And I thought, you know, that's kind of cool. I kind of like that. And so I started looking for more. Unfortunately, because of my job at the time, I spent a lot of time overseas, and so I didn't get to go to many furry cons until I permanently came back to the States in the later 90s. I switched from being a comic collector to a comic dealer, mostly because I had gotten married, my first son was born, and that baby stuff costs a fortune. And I decided that I didn't want to give up my hobby, but I didn't want to take money out of the family budget either, so I started selling off some of my excess comics to make a little extra bucks. And one day somebody said to me, "Do you buy collections?" And that was the end of it. I mean, I became full on my side of the table, not that side anymore. But as we have had more and more people come into the fandom has evolved drastically over time. In the beginning, in the late 70s and early 80s, most artists and writers focused almost strictly on general audience material. There were many people who were creators in the fandom at the time who felt that sexual material would give the fandom a bad name from the beginning. And they didn't want that. There was one creator, Reed Waller, who disagreed, and he created a fanzine called Voody. It's almost impossible to find copies of that fanzine. But he did adult sexual material in that fanzine, and he was, I wouldn't say ostracized, but he was not exactly welcomed by a lot of the other members of the community at the time. Not until he and his roommate, Kate Worley, created the comic book Omaha the Cat Dancer. Omaha was a character who was a stripper, and she had a boyfriend named Chuck. They're both cats, but their community involved a hooker who was a chicken, Omaha's roommate, and who was also a stripper, was a dog. They had a best friend who lived in the apartment complex that they lived in, who was a bear. It was a multi-species community. And that book, yes, it had nudity and sex in it, but it was not just for the gratuity sex. It was part of the story that continued on and drew people to it. And it's kind of funny, but in the early 80s, there was a raid, if you want to call it that, by a local district attorney and the police department on a comic book shop in Oklahoma City, because this Oklahoma comic shop was selling smut, where little Johnny bought his Batman. And it was a terrible thing. And, yeah.
So, I mean, they've also bought smut in those Atari game stores, and
yeah.
Nobody knew.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but we're talking to Oklahoma City here, which is in the middle of the Bible Belt. And, you know, this guy wanted to make a reputation for himself. So he collected these comics, and he brought the case before the judge. And the judge was a little confused. I mean, you're bringing a pornography case before me and you have comic books here, which didn't really make much sense to the judge. But he said, okay, hang on. I'm going to take this material. I'm going to go back to my chambers. I'm going to review this evidence, and then I'll come back. An hour later, he comes back after reading several copies of Omaha the Cat Dancer and dismissed the case, saying that Omaha was one of the best comic books he'd ever read in his life. Yeah. Everybody has certain opinions, and the judge's opinion counts most. But, it has had its ups and downs. As I said, a lot of people did not agree with sexuality in the fandom, but it did evolve over time. When I started as a dealer, still in the mid-90s, if you came to my table at a comic show, you would find that about 80% of what I sold was general audience, and 20% was adult material. But as time went on and more people came into the fandom, some people left, things evolve. Slowly, my 20% of adult material grew to half,
oh boy,
to 75%, to, by the mid-90s, I wouldn't have a general audience comic on my table because nobody wanted it. The general audience material stayed at home in the garage, and nothing went to the show except adult material. Right up until about 2012, and then the pendulum started moving again. And now, if you go down to my table tomorrow, you will find that half of my wall display is general audience, the other half is adult, and on the table, about 30% of the table is adult, and the other 70% is general audience. And that's because younger furs, like most of you, have decided that although sex is good, we actually want a good, well-written story to go along with the nice art. And, well, I have some adult Da Vinci Japanese furry stuff that's down there. And, okay, give me a raise of hands. How many of you know how to read Japanese? Which means you're buying that material to look at the pictures, not read the story.
I can barely read Japanese.
Just Mad Lib
it. Yeah. So, there is still and probably always will be a certain level of adult material within the fandom. And as people come and go, that pendulum will swing back and forth. I would like to be here for quite a few more years, chances are, at some point, I've known too many what we call grafers, and I'm in that club. We are moving on, passing the torch, so to speak, and newer people like yourself, most of you, are coming in with your own ideas. Some of you are artists, some of you are writers, some of you are creators of other material, and some of you are just want to enjoy the interaction and the fandom itself. The fact that you can make a friend. Maybe you won't see that friend again in person for another year until the next convention you're both at. I mean, but you have the ability to Skype and Zoom and all those other cool things on the internet that we could never do. I mean, it wasn't until, and most of you don't know this, but it wasn't until almost the mid-90s before the internet, which was created in the 80s, was available to everyday normal folks because nobody had a PC that could connect to it. And when you did, you had a PC like mine, 64 bits of RAM and 20,000 bits of hard drive space. And if you wanted to connect to the internet, you had to plug into your landline phone system, and you could download a 4K program in about 5 hours. So forget about, you know,
we're so spoiled.
The games you like to play today. Yes.
How heavy was it?
How what?
How heavy was it?
My computer? Maybe about 35 pounds.
Maybe.
Because it had a big old power supply in it, you know, and it had a motherboard with about 6 chips on it, you know, and that was the equivalent. Then you had your modem card to plug into the phone connection, but they should start, I'm sure somebody already has, started a computer technology museum. And if you went there, you'd probably find my Commodore 64 in the front row spot.
So I'll have to take my last one.
But you finally have a CD player in the museum.
No CD player. You had a cassette tape deck to use as a mag tape drive.
I remember even in the very early days of Anthrocon, they'd have an internet room. The screen was black. The type was yellow. No graphics. Login as guest, and it would take forever.
Yeah.
And I even remember, when I had before I had a broadband connection, I had dial-up. If you wanted to download a video or something like that, it would take you half an hour to do 10 seconds or something. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, broadband. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Actually, speaking of BBSs and all these fun things you can do. By the way, there's this great project where they'll let you play a 2600 tone into the phone, and it will simulate an old in-band signaling
idea.
But how influential was Usenet in the furry fandom? Was there any actual presence there?
No. No, most people back in those days who did have access, and not everybody did, because those computers were very expensive for the time.
I mean, more like in the 90s, though. Like, not, of course not during the Commodore 64. That would be a little bit...
Well, just a little bit, because my next computer that I got in 96 had about 100K of RAM, 100K of hard drive, and maybe... 64K of RAM.
So we're not talking 386.
No, I mean, if you want to get into a decent computer to access the internet, you got to talk 2000.
Really?
And before that, people would communicate when you had the ability. You'd be talking to one another on what they call bulletin boards, where you just went someplace, logged onto this thing, and you could leave a message for someone. And if they were logged in at the same time, you could actually have a conversation, but it was you typing and loading it up and waiting for the load to occur. Then they would read it, and then they would answer and load it up, and then you'd have to wait for them to load their answer back to you. It was not instantaneous like today is. Yes, sir.
Could you speak a bit more about the Peace Corps printing press thing?
Sorry, I can't understand you.
The Peace Corps printing press.
What about it?
Could you go into more detail about it? I haven't heard about it. I have one more.
It was a portable printing machine that IBM created for the government so that they could print educational books anywhere in the world in a multitude of languages. I mean, that was what it was originally designed for. I don't remember the name of it or what kind of designation that they gave to it, but it was portable enough so that all they needed to do was ship it, load in some liquid ink from a gallon bottle, put in a couple of reams of paper and some staples on one side, and plug in a memory chip, which was not as what you would consider a memory chip today. In some cases, I think the first machine actually had to be loaded by IBM punch cards or a paper case. And then they would hit run and pamphlets. I mean, we're not talking big hardcover 100-page books, but something along the lines of a pamphlet that was 30 pages would pop out, and they'd be able to hand them out to local children to teach them how to read, to teach them mathematics and basic educational skills. And that's what this machine was designed for. It wasn't until the cost of that machine got to the point where it was feasible to use in other applications, and people could say, I can buy one of those and go into business and call myself Kinko. That, you know, people started to use things like that instead of a copy machine. Because a copy machine at the post office or the library was the only thing that was available to early furry artists who wanted to produce what they call a fanzine. Does anybody have any other questions?
Furry Muck.
Yes.
Yeah, so are there some like big zines, like any zines that were like widely popular within the fandom back in the times when they were the most popular, you know, publication?
Well, it was just at the time it was something new that was not really available in the public perception. You got to remember that at the time, there were three major publishers of comic books: Marvel, DC, and Charlton. Marvel and DC did nothing but superheroes. They dabbled a little bit with funny animal stuff back in the 40s and 50s. But by the 1960s, it was all superheroes. And Charlton did a lot of non-superhero odd things. Like, Charlton had a run of cowboys. They had some science fiction. There was another publisher called EC that did a bunch of horror comics. But that was it. Furry was a breath of fresh air, but it was also very limited in its distribution. It wasn't until the mid-80s when small publishers could start printing their own books without having a 100,000 copy print run that the independent distribution network began, and comic shops didn't have to go to just Marvel and DC to get all of their books. And those books, by the way, went to newsstands and drugstores and anybody else that wanted to sell comics, and they were all the comics that were available. So comic shops didn't really have a special place in the retail community until all of these independent titles started popping up because of the print capabilities that were available to them. Yes?
In addition, there were amateur press associations, which were really among the people that belonged to it. It was just for them, all the different artists and things like that. They would print their own stuff. It would go to a central mailer who would compile it, and then it would go to the members. But if there were extra copies, they might sell them at a convention or something.
Right.
You might have an artist like Albert Temple, Gene Catlow, okay? He would put his own stuff in there that you'd find nowhere else. Now he's passed away, so you're not going to get anything from him anymore. But in addition, they would have comments. So he would talk to Scott Arsenal, he would talk to Mike Cazale or whatever, and you would have all these things. And it was like a whole bunch of different things. And I belonged to a couple non-furry apps, but it was the same idea where you would send it to a central mailer.
Yeah.
It was an interesting thing.
Yeah. The one of the books that has evolved from fanzine to an actual book is a title called Roar Brazel.
Yep.
Now, Roar Brazel is still in publication today, but like this gentleman said, it is only for contributing artists. So if you created a picture, you just a one-shot print of a sexy fox doing a sexy pose, and you sent it to Roar Brazel, they would include it, and they would send you a copy of the finished product with everybody else's art in it, too, besides yours. But you would get a copy. He couldn't, because he didn't contribute. And he couldn't even buy one unless he bought yours from you. Because if there was 150 contributors, there were 150 copies printed, and that was it. And everybody who contributed got one. Total. No more. I have on my table, sorry, commercial time, I have on my table a copy of Roar Brazel that dates from 1984 to 1996. But the only thing, the only art that's in that book is the cover art, front and back covers. None of the interior artwork is included in that book. And those books are for sale, but the publisher who creates that book on a regular basis had to get permission, because it's all creator-owned artwork. He had to get permission from every single artist who contributed and had that cover art originally supplied. He had to get everybody's written permission to have that book printed. And the only reason why he printed it and is selling it is to make money to pay for the printing costs for the next issues of Roar Brazel to be printed, so the money doesn't come out of his pocket to go to everybody else. Because when they send those copies, to the individual people, they're free. They don't say, oh, your copy is available, send me a check for $20. They just send you a copy because you contributed. Anybody else have a question? Yes.
You had mentioned that in the Golden Age, there were some anthropomorphic characters that were considerably less human and wouldn't have been called anthropomorphic, but were sort of the forerunners, and we call it anthropomorphic animals. What were some examples of those characters?
Oh, well, Felix the Cat was one, which you may or may not have heard of. Heckle and Jekyll is another one. Fox and Crow was another one. There was one called Gobbler, which featured a turkey. Mostly, that book only came out around Thanksgiving time, and it was how this turkey would evade losing his head during the holiday season. It was a lot of things like that. But like I said, they didn't wear clothes. They didn't drive cars and, you know, do things that humans do. They were just animals running around as animals, but had conversations and talked to one another. During my time as a child, when I would watch cartoons, there was things like Looney Tunes that were Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck. I mean, they were kind of an in-between of anthropomorphic and funny animal. They didn't wear clothes. You never saw Bugs in a suit or anything other than maybe Mickey Mouse in a bow tie. But, you know, Donald Duck did wear a hat and a top, but he didn't wear any bottoms. You know, they were the forerunners of anthropomorphics, but they were still considered funny animals. It wasn't until this book was printed, like I said, that the term anthropomorphics actually ingratiated the fandom. If you look in a dictionary and actually look up the term anthropomorphics, it doesn't necessarily point to our fandom. Anthropomorphics means any thing that takes on human characteristics. So if you're at the movies and just before the movie starts you see the box of popcorn and the soda dancing across the screen reminding you to go to the snack bar, that's anthropomorphics. Because those are inanimate objects that have people-type qualities. They're walking and talking and have eyes. And so, again, that's considered anthropomorphics as well.
And from 1949, not really clothed all that much, Pogo.
Yeah.
The whole cast there, Hokey Pinocchio, whatever the thing was, you know, definitely the same sort of thing. You know, and they had elections, they had a mailman, they had all this sort of stuff going on. They sang Christmas carols.
Yeah.
Perfect. Pogo.
Yeah. But again, it was still considered funny animals because the term anthropomorphics didn't come in as part of fandom until the 80s. Anybody else? Yeah?
I recently heard that apparently a good solid chunk of anime, the modern anime fandom, traces its origins back to like a lot of early furry conventions where people were swapping like tapes and stuff, and apparently that was like a really big thing that kind of led to modern anime conventions. Do you have anything about this at all?
No, I don't. As I said, I discovered the fandom at one point in my career in the Air Force, but then I went overseas and I was cut off from it at a time when it was blossoming in this country. And now, you may not be aware of it, but the fandom is worldwide now. A couple of years ago, before COVID, I actually had the privilege of going to Berlin and to the UK and attend furry conventions there. And I can't begin to tell you how many advertisements, little cards, piles of them, left on tables everywhere for a furry convention in Australia, another one in Japan, another one in Poland, another one in the Ukraine, another one in France, Germany, Switzerland, Sweden, you name it. Furries are everywhere now. And I also see that at the conventions we have here. One of my customers today, as a matter of fact, is from Qatar. Another one, I had several overseas customers who came to my table in when I was at Anthrocon this year. It's very, very international, and a lot of these people know that they can buy from me internationally. I ship anywhere. The only place I do not have a customer is Antarctica, and that's only because penguins don't know how to read yet. But I got a comic for him. I got a comic named Samurai Penguin.
When you were stationed overseas, where were you stationed?
I was stationed in the UK and I was stationed in Germany.
Huh.
Yes.
So in the early 70s, there was also another comic movement going on. Comics with an X.
Yeah.
It's basically adult comics like Fritz the Cat, Art Spiegelman's comics. Would you say there was any relation between that and the anthropomorphic slash funny animals?
Not directly. Because the adult comics that you're referring to, which are today are considered to be called underground, were mostly sold not in comic shops, but in head shops.
Ah.
So, you know, if you wanted to buy the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers, which, oh my God, they actually have a cartoon on television now.
Yep.
But if you wanted to see or buy Fritz the Cat or anything from Robert Crumb or Clay or any of the other, what they was called underground comic artists, you had to go to a head shop. They were not carried in local comic shops.
Because of the code?
Well, not because of the code, but because the distribution didn't allow it. Those comic publishers used a specific distributor that only distributed to certain stores, and comic shops were not on their list.
Ah.
So a comic shop couldn't even place an order for those books. It was just the two never quite came together. It wasn't until much later in the late 90s that you could buy underground comics for sale in a regular comic shop. And not until Diamond and Capital City started the major distribution of comics through the United States did that become available. And even through them, it was difficult. You had to place a special order in the adult section of the catalog, which was not available for print. I mean, it, maybe today you've gone to your local comic shop and seen a copy of Previews from Diamond Comics. The adult comics were never listed in Previews. You had to get a separate adult supplement to get any adult comics, and that's where the undergrounds were located. So if your comic shop was just not interested in carrying that kind of material, he still didn't have the opportunity to order it. Anything else? No? Well, yes.
You said, you mentioned before that they were called funny animals and anthropomorphic. Do you know when the first usage of the term furry was?
Yeah. Shortly after anthropomorphics was used. Furry wasn't actually utilized in the comics. It was utilized by people who started to attend the conventions. And then it was picked up by the media who wanted to make fun of it. Yeah. But when somebody comes up to me on the street or I'm at a convention or something, and we're not the only people at this hotel right now. There's plenty of non-furs at this hotel. Sometimes I run into folks like that in the elevator, and they'll say to me, "What's going on here? We just got here for a vacation weekend, and there's people running around in mascot suits." And what I do is I explain it by saying, "Well, have you ever seen the Disney cartoon Robin Hood? Where Robin Hood is a wolf, a fox, Maid Marian is a fox, Little John is a bear, King John, or Prince John is a lion. Have you ever seen that cartoon?" And they say, "Oh, yeah." And I say, "Well, that's anthropomorphics. Animals that act and talk like people." And that's what this convention is all about. It's people who want to act and talk like animals acting like people. And they go, "Oh, okay." And that kind of puts them at ease and gives them a little bit better understanding of what the fandom is. But, you know, that's like 10 seconds of elevator talk. It's not really, you know, what we're talking about here tonight. Anything else? I mean, that cartoon is an excellent example. If you have friends at home or you meet somebody, just give them that example. Disney's Robin Hood. It's great.
The bad guys, Zootopia. There was actually one about a year or two ago. Mel Brooks took his own Blazing Saddles and made it into one about cats and dogs. And that was Paws of Fury, The Legend of Hank. And what sold that story to me, okay, so if you can imagine the plot of Blazing Saddles, except it's all samurais and things like that, what sold it to me was the character played by Samuel L. Jackson said, "What the mother father cocker spaniel is going on here?" And I said, "Oh my God, I got to see this movie." And they got away with that, of course, poking fun at the way he talked and everything, all the swearing. And it was a pretty good movie. If you like Blazing Saddles, you'd probably like Paws of Fury.
Okay.
And you know who's in it? George Takei. Oh my. Oh my. He's in it, yeah.
Okay. Well, if anybody has
Blazing
any
Samurai
more questions, you're more than welcome to stop by my table tomorrow or Sunday.
Yeah.
Say hi. Let me know if you enjoyed the con or if I can shut up and not do it again.